Good evening, everyone. So we're going to look into precepts today. Now, what is the meaning of precepts? What does precepts mean? What does precepts mean? Guidelines, very good. Guidelines, yes. So guidelines for our behavior, guidelines for our life. So all religions have some kinds of precepts. So that's why sometimes people do not like to follow any religion. They say, I like to be free. Why do I want to go follow a religion and then be abide by the being controlled by the precepts? So all these guidelines. So what is the purpose of all these precepts or guidelines? So today we're going to talk about guidelines or precepts in Buddhism. So in Buddhism, the word precepts was initially the words from Pali or Sanskrit, which is sila. Sila actually means calm and peaceful. In other words, it actually means that if you follow these guidelines, it should achieve the purpose of having a peaceful and calm mind. So in other words, the effect of following the precepts is that you should achieve peacefulness of mind. So if you follow precepts or some guidelines, but at the end, you get more and more frustrated, that means you have not been following the precepts in the right way. So sila in Buddhism are basically advice from the Buddha. The Buddha did not just sit down there and start to write rules and say, now I'm the Buddha, I'm the great teacher for everyone. Now, if you like to be my students, you need to follow my rules. He did not set rules as such. Initially, when the Buddha attained enlightenment, he didn't set any rules at all. So there are people who heard about the Buddha's enlightenment and encountered his teachings. Then later you found that there are people who like his teaching, who wants to follow his teaching and become monks and nuns. So the Buddha gathered them and formed the Sangha order. Initially, even the Sangha order do not have rules and regulations. The Buddha only give everyone a general principle. Do good, not to do bad. To purify your mind, this is the teaching of the Buddha. Simple as it is. And those people who were with the Buddha during Buddha's time, they were all with good spiritual foundation, and they all have this enthusiasm, admiration to the Buddha. And they all come with genuine heart to practice. So that's why they all want to know how to end suffering, how to attain real peace and ease. So they just follow the teachings without the necessary, very specific guidelines on what are the things that you have to do, what are the things that you do not need to do, you can't do. So it was said that in the first 12 years of the Sangha order, there were no rules, specific rules and regulations set. Everyone just followed the teachings and tried to practice diligently, and everyone are quite pure in their mind. It is only until Buddhism become popular that even when you start to get support from the king and so on, then you find that there's a lot of offerings that comes in, and there are people who start to join who join the order may not be that genuine in their intention anymore. So then you find, or sometimes because of some other circumstances, that family pressure or things as such, that some are forced to go back to be with the wife and so on. So all this incident happened, and that it bring distress to some of the monks after they did something which is not in line with practice, because they were so good in their own, they are actually having a very good mind to practice, but because of the external factor that's pressurizing them, and they did something they feel guilty, and at the end they feel very remorse themselves until they can practice. Because whenever you sit down, oh, I did this when I went home, they just feel so remorse and the mind cannot be at peace. Then the Buddha start to set some guidelines that when you are out or when you are forced to do certain things, just make sure there are certain things that you definitely cannot do, so that you don't bring remorse to yourself in your practice, and also not to bring harm to others. So the Buddha's precepts for the monks and nuns was only set after, it was says, according to the Vinaya, it was only 12 years after the Buddha attained enlightenment. Now the five precepts that we want to talk about was set by the Buddha for the lay people. So when the Buddha attained enlightenment, initially people who met the Buddha and wants to become the Buddha's disciple, the Buddha tell them to go to the Buddha for refuge, go to the Dharma for refuge, go to the Sangha for refuge. Have you heard of the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha as the triple gem? And so in Buddhism, it's just like in Christianity, you have a rite of initiation. In Buddhism as well, someone who wants to commit themselves as a Buddhist, they make vow that they want to go to the Buddha for refuge, go to the Dharma for refuge, go to the Sangha for refuge. What does this mean? It basically means that, what, refuge. What does refuge mean?
Guidance.
Guidance. Or protection. Shelter. Refuge, right? So we seek for refuge. We seek for shelter and protection. So in other words, we go to the Buddha to seek for protection. Under the we like to live under the shelter, in other words, the guidance of the Buddha, and that we also need to follow the Dharma, because the Buddha has attained enlightenment. He shared with us his teaching. The Buddha, as we say, is like a teacher. He can't just touch our head and make us transform us to become an enlightened one. So a teacher can keep teaching, persuading, encouraging, nagging, but at the end we have to practice, right? So what's important for us as well, besides the Buddha as a noble person, his teaching is very important. It's something that we need to respect. So that's why we go to the Dharma for refuge as well. In other words, we will look upon the Buddha as our role model. We will follow the teachings of the Buddha. And also, when we follow the teachings of the Buddha, especially for us who are in this era, the Buddha, we are not born during the Buddha's era, we can only rely on the Dharma to help us. But then, there are these Dharma books in your universe library, set of Tripitaka, but how many people really go and look and read through it? And so therefore, you find that we need some teachers or tutors who have spent a bit more time in learning the subject to share with you their experience in practice and give you encouragement when it's necessary. So that's why the Sangha members are people who devote their life in learning the Buddha's teaching. They become like a bit more expert in this area. It's just like you have a professor in mechanical engineering, you have professor in biology, you have professor in chemistry. They spend a bit more time in learning that. It doesn't mean that you cannot be expert. It's just that because the monks and nuns devote their life in learning, they it's basically their duties and their whole life. So they spend 24 hours learning it. And so, of course, they have a bit more experience in learning the subject. And so, therefore, when for all of us, when we are learning, you find that when you encounter difficulties, you can go to the Sangha members to seek for help and guidance. And also, the Sangha order carry with them a very important responsibility, that is to pass on the right teachings of the Buddha. So the Buddha was very, very wise. Because when people got interested in the teaching and wants to become monks and nuns, the Buddha didn't just let them live individually and just teach them individually. He grouped them as a Sangha order and then set rules and regulations for the Sangha order to make sure that they maintain the purity of the Sangha order. Because if we practice individually and in individual environment, then you find that, okay, after I pass away, if I have a few disciples which are good, that's good. If not, then this is the end. But if you have a Sangha order, which is a collective effort of not necessarily people who come from the same family, but people with same ambition, that is, they want to learn the Buddha's teaching. They like the right teachings to be prolonged. Because if you pass on to a family, it's just like you find a family business. The father like to be a like to run a furniture shop business. You pass on to the son. Maybe the grandchildren do not like it anymore, and then they will sell the business. That's the end. So same thing. If the Buddha's teaching is passed on to families, then it's not necessary that it's going to last very long. But it's passed on to the Sangha order. That mean, and it's not limited whoever is in the Sangha order. They are all with the same ambition. That is, they want to learn the teachings. They want to prolong the teachings. And it's with people with the same aim that comes together with the same intention of purifying themselves and making sure that the Buddha's teaching can be prolonged, that they can practice, learn as much as they can, and pass on the right teaching. And that's how we can still have the Buddha's teaching 2,600 years later. And in order for this Sangha order to pass on the right teachings of the Buddha, then we have to make sure that this Sangha order maintains its purity. And that's why initially the Buddha did not set precepts for the Sangha order, but later when there are other Sangha members, the standard of the Sangha members start to vary, and that there are also people who start to get carried away by their desire and so on, then the Buddha set some rules to ensure that within the Sangha order, the Sangha members have to follow this rule to make sure that this Sangha order are always in harmony, peaceful, and everyone maintain their diligence and purity. So that's why for the Sangha order's precepts, there are basically a few categories. One section are basically telling us things which should not be done. It's basically an elaboration from the five precepts. It's just going to a bit more refined. But the principle is no other than the five precepts. And that's why five precepts is actually the basic precepts. And then there's one section that tell us things we should not do so that we do not bring disturbance to others. Because as Sangha members, you live together in a community. So there could be some rules which not necessarily very, very sinful, but it can obstruct your own practice as well as bring disturbance to others. For example, you have to walk gently, don't bang the door, and also some of the rules that, like for example, keeping food in your bedroom and things like that. What you say is sinful, it's not necessarily that sinful, but it shows your desire that I'll keep some under my table when at night no one sees, I can continue eating. Or you say it's sinful, you don't hurt anyone, but it's not good for your own practice. And that's a desire. So there are certain rules which are as such. And there are also certain rules that was set to avoid the people's criticism. As those rules, a lot of them can be related to the culture as well, but then some of them can also be related to our unnecessary desire. For example, one of the common one that some of you probably knows is that the monks and nuns are not supposed to ride a car. So this day you find that Theravada monk don't drive a car. Why? It was very interesting. When the Buddha said the precepts, he did not actually, as I say, he did not just sit down there and write all the precepts. He only said the precepts when incident happened. So during Buddha's time, riding horse cart, or they do have cars like what we have today, riding horse cart and things like that, it was actually for someone who is very rich and is basically a kind of luxurious enjoyment. So as Buddhism became popular, they got a lot of support from rich family, support from the kings, and so on. So there were a lot of people who started to join the Sangha order because they thought, oh, there's a lot of offerings. Well, that happened in China over time as well. in China, there are times when Buddhism become popular and get all the support of the emperor, and that's where you start to see that the qualities of the Sangha members start to get mixed. You got some very good monks, but then you start to have some people who become monks just because they have a difficult life outside, and so therefore that's another way to get in. And even up to today, you find that some things still happen. And so their qualities of the Sangha members start to get a bit mixed. Yeah. So they and some of them could be young. And so there was an incident where a few junior monks, they are befriended with some wealthy man's children. So they have this horse cart that the wealthy children always ride around showing off themselves and having fun and just show off to the villagers. So they invite all these monks to come along. So the monks get into the horse cart and they ride around the villagers and wave to everyone and show off themselves how enjoyable they are. And so the villagers feel it's not appropriate. It's like we, as a lay person, we don't even have this kind of enjoyment. And you, as a monk, you're supposed to be practicing and be content and have less desire. And then you're just riding around and showing off that you are on the horse cart, right? So and then they go and complain to the Buddha. Then the Buddha asks these few monks to come. If you do such a things at certain time, and certain date. So Buddha was very democratic. So he basically asked the people involved to come along and ask them what happened. And then the Buddha said, well, yeah, this is not a good action, action for yourself and not for others. Firstly, when you ride on the cart, you are not using it as a vehicle, but you have been carried away by your desire and enjoyment. This is not conducive to your practice. You forgot to look inward and check your mind. So this is not a right behavior. And secondly, because this kind of entertainment during the culture at that time is not appropriate for the monks, and it sort of create unnecessary, create criticism from the villagers, and it will then defame Buddhism as a whole. So therefore, from now on, the monks and nuns are not supposed to ride a cart. And that's how the Buddha set the rules. So it was very democratic, and that's why this rules were set in the Vinaya for the monks and nuns. So that's why you can see that when the Buddha set the rules and guidelines, it's always either, why did the Buddha set the precepts, as we say, it was just advice to help us. So firstly, make sure that our behavior do not bring harm to others. So the Buddha set the precepts with compassion. Firstly, make sure that we are not being carried away by our selfish desire, hatred, arrogance, or jealousy, and bring harm to others. So he need to set some guideline. And then secondly, make sure that we do not engage into these wrong actions and speech and thought that brings suffering to ourselves. All right? And so thirdly, not to engage in all these bad habits that will actually develop further our desire that at the end bring obstacle to our own practice. And also he wants to set these rules so that it helps us to develop good habits that will be more conducive for our own practice. See, so this basically advises from the Buddha to help us. In fact, if the Buddha just set a general guideline to do good, not to do bad, to purify your mind, this is a teaching of Buddha. If you know how to use this guideline, you'll find that the five precepts is easy to follow. But then, not many people is able to justify, like, okay, now I should do this. Is it the right thing to do or wrong thing to do? And then you say, what is right? What is bad? And a lot of times people are unclear how to draw a line. So to make it easier for general people, then the Buddha set the guidelines. So the Buddha set the five precepts when lay people go to the Buddha. So we say, just then, we say, when someone wants to become Buddhist, they take refuge in the Buddha. I go to the Buddha for refuge, I go to Dharma for refuge, I go to Sangha for refuge. In other words, we'll follow the guidelines of the teaching. And basically, initially, that was how a person become a Buddhist, and then they just follow the Buddha's teaching, and that was all good. But then later, there are people of this. They go to the Buddha again and say, "Yes, Buddha, we like to follow your teachings. But can you give us more specific guidelines so that we can have a happy and peaceful life?" So that's why when people go to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha for refuge, the Buddha that would then explain to them to be a good disciple of the Buddha, and to make sure that you have a peaceful and happy life, you follow the five precepts. And that's why taking refuge in the triple gem and the five precepts is actually followed one after another. So it's just like someone wants to become Buddhist, then the Buddha said, okay, these are the guidelines that you should follow in order to be a good Buddhist. It's just like you go to a school. You say, okay, I like to be, and you go and see the principal tell you about this school and say, oh, okay, be a good boy in this school, these are our school rules, right? So the same thing. So that's why the Buddha set the five precepts when lay people ask the Buddha how can they have a happy and peaceful life. So the Buddha set the precepts as firstly, as we say, intention is out of compassion to help, to make sure that we don't harm others and also don't bring obstacle and suffering to ourselves. So these five precepts, these precepts that the Buddha said, are also in accordance to the law of cause and effect. The Buddha did not just set the rules out of thinking, okay, what should I put into the rules? The Buddha set all these rules. In fact, you find that the five precepts is in line with the teaching of cause and effect. We all like to be happy. We want to have a peaceful life. So in other words, we want our mind to not be in guilty remorse all the time. We want our life to be safe. You do not need to worry someone is taking revenge on you at any time. Right? And then we also like to be happy and peaceful in a sense that people around us can be trust, we can trust one another, and that we are that people around us are supporting one another, have good respect to one another, and that we can live together happily. And also we want to have a clear mind, a wise mind, right? So how can we make sure that we cultivate the right causes and conditions so that we can lead to this kind of effect where your life is peaceful, safe? Like, you do not need to worry someone is taking revenge on you, someone is going to harm you, you don't want this to happen. And also you want your people around you are respectful person, that everyone support one another, everyone are friendly, in harmony, and everyone can be trusted, and that everyone are wise. You see, if we live in a society as such, how peaceful it is. Not like today. You go out on the street, you do not know what is going to happen. We read too many news in these past 3 or 4 weeks. It's getting terrible. Why? So, if we want to make sure that our life is safe, the cause and effect is that don't harm others. Right? So, we need to cultivate, if we want the effect, which is we are safe, we are always peaceful, no one is going to harm us, we have to make sure that we don't harm others. It's cause and effect. So that's why first precepts the Buddha tells us, no killing. Don't threaten others' life. Because everyone loves their life, and everyone do not like their life to be threatened. Same like us. We are all ordinary person. We all still love our life. Including the animals, they love their life. But the five precepts the Buddha said was for beginners, so its main target was saying to tell us not to kill human beings. But of course, not saying that, not only that we should not kill or hurt human beings, then we have to understand that animals have feelings as well. Insects have feelings as well. Worms have feelings as well. Birds have feelings as well. Fish has feelings as well. So don't harm them. Because you can see, like, fish struggling when they are hurt, right? Your kitten, you pull the tail, they get angry. So, just remember, do not bring harm to others because everyone loves their life. If we want our life to be safe, then make sure that we value others' life and try to protect others' life. Understand that we are all sentient beings. We got caught in our ignorance and go around the cycle of life and death. So, although this is a crocodile, it's because of the past unwholesome karma that is reborn as a crocodile, but then it has feeling as well. So we should have sympathy rather than have hatred in killing things as such. So, but of course, so in the five precepts, the main target is no killing of human being, but then we should also develop the mind of loving kindness and compassion and to care for all lives. Okay? But of course, the sin or the unwholesome karma that we created as compared to stepping on an ant and killing a cow differs. Because you can see, a cow is such a big animal. And if you can intentionally kill the cow, that shows how cruel is your mind. But if you walk and accidentally step on an ant, and then you feel sorry, right? But at least because you didn't see, it's not intentional. The cruelty in your mind is less. And that's why the karma that created would be different as well. It actually comes from how cruel is your mind that actually lead to how severe is the unwholesome karma. So if it's a human being and that you can, or even a human being that you know, your parents and so on, who have been so kind to you, and because of your own greed, some people because of their wealth, they want their parents' wealth, and they took all this silly action in harming their own parents. That is very, very bad. Okay? So, five precepts. The first thing, no killing. Second, no stealing. We all like our property to be safe. So, don't try to take other people's property or without permission. So, stealing, it can be big stealing. It can be small stealing, like taking advantage of things. Some people like to, for example, you'd like to do some cheating in getting what you want. Or people like to get away, run away, get away from taxation or something like that. You find some loopholes and try to get more return for yourself. These are actually not very good. Or for example, but in Australia we have Centrelink's benefit and so on. Some people try to find loopholes and apply for more benefit than what they are supposed to have. These are actually all not good. Because we have to understand, all this money, for example, taxation, we are supposed to give it to the government. Now, at least in Australia, the government use it for a lot of education, hospital, and so on. It's quite different when you are in a corrupt country. But in Australia, for example, that all the taxation goes to a lot of all these charity, hospital, schools, nursing home, and so on. For the infrastructure of the society. So it comes from a lot of people and it goes back to the society. And that's how we can manage and maintain the progress of the society and also reduce the disparity between rich and poor. But if everyone try to find loopholes and get away, then how can the government run the society, run the country? There will be a big problem. But then, of course, you got other people who are corrupt, who try to take money without in an unlawful way. So those are actually not the right way, and it's kind of stealing, right? And we have to understand. Now you try to cheat and try to have more for yourself. We are actually using up our merits first, the good karma that we have first. For example, a lot of time people try to get a bit more tax return. But how much extra do you get back? A few thousand dollars? But without that few thousand dollars, can't you just continue to live happily? But sometimes people find, oh, if I don't take back this few thousand dollars, I feel like not worth it. But in fact, when you take that few thousand dollars back, you don't actually use it. You just put it into your bank. You still have sufficient for yourself. But who knows, when you come to your old age, and the time when you want to rely on pension, when you want to rely on government's social welfare support, and if at that time the society has changed, government has changed, and the country become poorer, well, when country become poorer, the government will have to reduce all this social welfare. And then maybe by the time when you need it, you got no more. You see? So if we have good karma, we just keep it. Then the good karma will protect you when it's needed. Good karma is the best investment. The external thing, money, will depreciate. But good karma will be with you. That's something that we need to understand when we talk about cause and effect. So do not think that I just feel I'm such a silly person if I don't take the advantage that's right in front of me. Just leave it as a backup, and you find that the good karma can protect you. So it's no stealing. We all like to not allow our things to be lost, and no sexual misconduct or no adultery. No adultery basically means, besides lawful husband and wife, one should not have extramarital affair. And that's a very important rule that the Buddha said. Some people thought, why the Buddha talk about no adultery, no sexual misconduct? Remember, this question was asked by the lay people. They asked the Buddha, how can we have a happy and peaceful life? Now, to create a happy and peaceful life, especially for a lay person, the nucleus of the family, the husband and wife, are loving one another, caring one another. It helps to build a healthy and peaceful family, and also help to have happy children. That's very important. So if the nucleus of the family, the husband go and look for girlfriend, the wife go and look for boyfriend, then this family is going to be chaos, and then the children will also suffer. And then what will be next? Social problem. And that's why sometimes when we were teaching the young kids, the kids, oh, what would the Buddha talk about? Not adultery. It's actually for the harmony of the family. And you find that it actually can affect the society. And looking at the society that we have today, because of a lot of broken family, and you have children who grow up in a family which is they don't have a very balanced childhood development, and it has long-term impact in their psychology, which leads to a lot of social problem as well. And that's why you can see why the Buddha is very, very wise. And at the same time, he was very compassionate, because the five precepts are set for lay people who start to learn Buddhism, beginners. So he did not say no sexual conduct at all. unlike when we talk about the eight precepts, if we have time, we talk a bit of eight precepts afterwards, then that is, eight precepts are set by the Buddha for people who want to experience monastic life, then it's no sexual conduct at all. But for lay people, he said, work within your right. Respect your partner, respect your spouse, and with mutual respect, you can have a happy and peaceful life. And at the end of the day, when you go extramarital affair, it's basically showing our desire that's going too far. And you bring disturbance to other people's family. Not only your family got disturbed, other people's family got disturbed. It's not good at all. Okay? And then number four is no lying, do not tell lies. So we all like to live in a society where we can trust one another. But if we can't trust one another, you find that it gives us extra burden. Like for example, if we have a tradesman that come and do painting, and this painter is very trustworthy, and you just tell them anything, they treat it like they are painting for their own house, and they do it properly, then you feel relaxed. You just let them do, and you trust them, they trust you, that you're not going to run away, you'll pay them. Everyone is good, easy. But if you got a person who come, whom you need to keep an eye all the time, otherwise they will try to cheat, and they will try to use a second class material for you, and so on, then you have to keep looking at this person, and then this person also get upset because you're keeping an eye on him or her. It's making everyone unhappy, isn't it? So if we can trust one another and everyone's honest with themselves, it's much, much easier. So no lying. In the five precepts, the worst lying, the big lie that that's going to create serious karma, is to say that you have a certain attainment, but in fact you didn't actually have those kind of attainment. For example, some people say, "Oh, I think I can attain fourth jhana. I think I have supernatural power." All these things that they say, "I think I'm a living Buddha." All this. Saying something where you didn't achieve, but you boast around it and say that you have achieved that, and that you actually lie to others and cheat others, and and people start to trust you, and that is the big lies which can lead to very, very severe karma. Okay, so that's no lying. And then number five is no intoxicants. Not taking things that confuse our mind. So we all like to have a clear mind. We like to be wise. So of course, cause and effect, we don't take things that confuse our mind. Right? Some people say, "Oh, what about if I take a sip?" Well, why do you need to take a sip then? Just for the taste of it? Then that's desire. See? So, and then sometimes people say, "Oh, well, that's a culture in my office. Every Friday after work, we drink. If I don't drink, people feel that I'm antisocial." Do you have that problem? Some of you may have this problem, especially those of you who just started work. Sometimes I just tell the person, I say, "Well, if the doctor tells you that you should not drink, then you will probably tell your colleagues that my doctor say I cannot drink," and then everyone will accept it, and people wouldn't think that you are antisocial. So if you tell your friends that drinking, "My doctor tell me drinking is not good," all doctors will say so. Right? So, and usually people may think that you are antisocial, or people may tease you for not drinking for a few times, and once they get over that few times, they will stop. As long as they understand you are a friendly person, you are a helpful person, you help them when they need help, then you find that they will stop the teasing. Because at the end of the day, if they only want to friend with you because you drink, and if you don't drink, they don't want to friend with you, then well, this is just a very superficial friendship. Don't worry so much. A good friend will not just don't want to friend with you just because you don't drink. Is that right? If your good friend don't want to friend with you anymore just because you don't drink, that's a bit, what do you call that? Childish. Right? So, because what makes up the friendship is mutual respect, mutual understanding, mutual support, mutual caring, mutual comfort, right? All this makes up the good bonding or good friendship. A friend who help us, whom we support one another and grow together. If a friend only want to friend with you just because, only if you drink or you smoke, then don't take it too seriously. Don't you think so? Right? So especially in the company, your colleagues may just tease you, but then at work, when they encounter difficulties, you can help them. And when they are stressed out, you offer your help. They know that you are a good person. They will still friend with you. They know that you are not antisocial. So that's why, don't worry about people talking about you antisocial. We help in the right way. And just take a few weeks, you find that people knows you well. Yeah. So no intoxicants. We do not want to confuse our mind, so therefore don't take things that confuse us. And the Buddha said, "The no killing, no stealing, no lying, no adultery, these four usually are being acknowledged as immoral in most religion as well. Whereas no intoxicants, taking drinks, some religion may not ban that, but the Buddha set these rules as a preventive rules. Right? As some of you may say, oh, a sip doesn't cause me drunk, but who knows? Depends, because some people say, oh, if I drink this bit, I know that this won't get me drunk. I will limit myself. But, you know, everything is causes and conditions. Sometimes when your physical health is in a different state, sometimes a little bit of it can make you drunk, although your normal quantity is that much. But because at certain time, when your physical health is different, you find that, how come today I drink this much, I got drunk? You see, so it's difficult. And the Buddha set these rules as preventive rules. In the sutra, in the Vinaya, he actually tells us a story as well. There were a few stories about drinking. One was the Udayin story, that this monk was a very, very well-practiced monk. There was a village where there was a poisonous snake that came into the village, and the poisonous snake bring a lot of disturbance to the villagers because everyone was very, very worried. So they went to the Buddha and asked the Buddha for help. What can we do with this poisonous snake? So Udayin, the monk, heard about it. Said, "Okay, I'm going to tame this." This poisonous snake. So he went to the village because he was very good in his practice. His mind was peaceful and he has very good meditation practice. So with his practice, he tamed the poisonous snake and then he actually guided the poisonous snake back to the forest. So villagers were very, very happy and so they want to thank him. So at that time, well, it's just like a lot of culture. Sometimes giving a bottle of wine is a kind of gift. So they thought, oh, that's probably the best gift that we can give to him. So the monks has got they usually have a water bottle. So they pour the wine into his water bottle as a gift to him. At that time, the Buddha have not set this no intoxicantness yet. You see, the Buddha only set when incidents happen. So this monk, walking back to the Buddha's place, halfway through he was thirsty and he drank. And then he got drunk. So he got drunk and he was lying at the roadside. Then the Buddha and other monks came along. They saw this Udayin lying at the roadside, drunk. And a frog was jumping on his head. So the Buddha said, look at Udayan. He was such well-practiced, so strong, that he was able to tame a poisonous snake where no one can tame. But look at him now. Even a frog can jump on his head. So then the Buddha said, from now on, everyone should not drink alcohol. Because when you drink, you lost your rationality, you lost your strength. And worse is that you can sometimes break all five precepts at the same time. There's another story. They're talking about drinking. Because of drinking, a person broke five precepts at the same time. So this man was drinking at home. He was drunk. And the neighbor has some chicken. The chicken flew over. So he caught the chicken and he slaughtered the chicken and cooked the chicken. And then he continued eating with his wine. Then the neighbor's wife came along and said, I saw my chicken flew over. Did you see my chicken? Then this man said, No. I didn't see anything. And because he was drunk, he abused the neighbor's wife as well. So you can see that just within a few minutes, he broke all five precepts at the same time. First, he drank, of course, he broke the no intoxicant. So the chicken flew over. He caught the chicken. So which rules that he have broken?
Stealing.
And then he slaughtered the chicken. And then the neighbor wife came and asked, and he said, whether he saw the chicken. He said no. So that's lying. And then he abused the neighbor's wife. And that actually shows that a lot of people are actually they uphold their dignity very well when they were not drunk. But when they're drunk, you find that they do all silly things. They damage their own property, they kill, they fight with others, they swear, and that's why you find that there are some general manager of big company, if they end up drunk in the pub, they can tell everyone their secret. Or a politician, if they got caught, they ruin their own future. And that's why the Buddha said no intoxicant as a preventive precept, because after all, the intoxicants doesn't help us at all. And you find in our society today, I find that in our society today, two very major problems that we have is adultery, intoxicants, that create a lot of problem in our society. I'm not sure if you agree with me, but that's what I see. Intoxicants, drugs, drinking, I think major problem in our society. Adultery, too casual with sexual relationship, that's also creating a lot of problem. And then it creates a lot of chaos to the society. A lot of newborn baby without proper parents, single mom, and then at the end, even the single mom was too young. How are these babies going to grow up? It's very pitiful. And that creates a lot of social problems. So with this, you find that when you develop further with these children who were born and not being well taken care of, when they grow up, it's going to be further social problem, and it's a vicious cycle that keep going wrong. And that's why if you think about the precepts that the Buddha said, he was very, very wise. Very, very wise. It's 2,600 years ago, setting these precepts to ensure happiness of individual, happiness for the society. That's very, very wise. Yeah. So that's why we should appreciate the Buddha's teaching. It helped us to set a guideline to understand whether these are the things that we should do the things that we should not do. So the five precepts are basically the foundation. We say, sometimes we say, it's the basis to be a human being. Because you think about it, as a human being, we have the sense of shame, we have the ability to understand good teaching, we have the ability to correct ourselves, we can also have courage and determination to practice if we want to. And human being, we always think that we are better than other sentient beings because we have better intelligence. But are we upholding our dignity as a human being? So if you think about a person who are born as a human being, but kill as they wish, steal as they wish, have adultery as they wish, and just tell lies without any feeling of remorse, and get themselves drunk all the time, do you think this person behaves like a human being? Because as a human being, as you say, we can think, we have better thinking skill as compared to other sentient beings. But if we get ourselves drunk all the time, you're not making full use of yourself as a human being. And we don't have this sense of, if we can't control our desire, our hatred, and just let it grow and kill and steal as we wish, then there's no difference to the animals. Fittest survive, and we keep fighting. You find that if you have dogs, you have two plates of food for the two dogs that you have. You say, this is yours, don't fight. You find that the dogs will try to eat the other plate first, and then step on this one, and don't let the other dog take it. You say, no, that is not yours, don't steal. They don't listen to you. Last time we have two dogs at the monastery as well, and we have two big basket for them to sleep in. There's one dog, he jumped into one basket, and then the other one was coming to the other basket. He did not want the other dog to go into the basket, he'd have his two legs on the wall. And standing there all the time and don't let the other dog come in. You have your own share, but our desire, selfishness, is just as such. And that's why, as a human being, if we can't have used our rationality to tell ourselves that this is not the right thing to do and respect one and other's property, then we are no different to the animal. And sexual misconduct, just having sexual relationship anywhere, that's only the animals who are doing that. Right? So therefore, we need to uphold our dignity as a human being. If we hope that we can have a happy and peaceful life, and also a happy future life. Because at the end, at least we hope that in the future life, we continue to be a human being, a better human being, or heavenly beings. We want to make sure that we continue to be a human being. But if now, when we are human being, we do not uphold the dignity as a human being, and do not value the human existence, and behave like a human being, we are not used to the habits of a human being. The habits of the human being is that we are more rational. We have sense of shame, certain things that is not right, we don't do it, right? We learn to correct ourselves, we have respect to one another, right? So if you as a human being, we don't even respect ourselves as a human being, and do not develop the habits like a human being, then when you are reborn as a, if you are reborn as a human being, you probably are not used to it because your habits are not like human beings. And so therefore we may reborn as an animal then. So that's why we say five precepts is the basis to become a human being again. If we can't pass, if we can't uphold the five precepts, then we may even have a risk of not being reborn as a human being. So that's why five precepts is a very important precepts a set of precepts for us to follow. It set a guideline for us to uphold our dignity as a human being. Okay? So that we, and not only that we uphold not killing, not stealing, no adultery, no sexual, no lying, no intoxicants in a, just a very, just uphold the precepts in a very superficial way, but we want to go a bit more in depth in making sure that we, besides no killing, we go a bit more proactive in care for life. Besides no stealing, we practice generosity. Besides no adultery, we learn to have good respect, loyalty, faithfulness to one another, encourage harmony and trustworthiness among one another. No lying, besides making sure that we don't tell lies, we try to give words of honesty, we try to give words of encouragement, words of comfort, to that make people feel trustworthy and happy. And besides no intoxicants, we want to practice mindfulness, meditation, listen to Dharma, develop wisdom. Then, besides meeting the passing mark of 5 precepts only, you got probably high distinction. Then, you find that when you're reborn as a human being again next life, you will be a human being who is wise, who have all this good respect and kindness and good moral values because of the habits that you have developed this life. So that's why we need to make sure that we uphold the 5 precepts well. Now, the 5 precepts, sometimes some people say, what happened if I accidentally break the precepts or didn't uphold the precepts well? What should I do? So now, important thing is that we need to have good respect to the precepts. We try to uphold the precepts as much as we can. All right? So now, some people may say, oh yeah, I only take refuge in the Triple Gem. I don't actually officially take the precepts or make vow that I'm going to take the 5 precepts, so it doesn't really matter to me. But we have to remember, yes, you didn't actually make promise that you want to uphold the precepts, but then the cause and effect is still the same, especially for killing, stealing, and so on. Whether you uphold the precepts, whether you officially make promise that I'm going to uphold the precept or not, when you don't do the right thing, the karmic effect is still going to come back to you. But if someone who have already uphold the precepts and knows that this is definitely not right, and then you intentionally break the precepts, then that's even worse, right? But if you are in a situation where you're forced to break a precept, for example, you uphold the precepts of no drinking, and your friend is very, very naughty and try to force you to drink. And so in the last moment that you find that you can't push away your friends anymore and you have to drink, you may just want to say, I give up these precepts. Give up the precepts of no intoxicant. So that you actually make sure that you respect these precepts. You don't want to break it. You give it up for that moment. And next time when there is a chance, you can go to a venerable and say, I'd like to take up these precepts again. It shows your respect that you really feel that this precept is so good. I do want to break it. But then because under that circumstances where my friends have already pushed until when I can't reject anymore, you let go of these precepts and the next time you take it up again. So if accidentally we didn't do well in our upholding precepts, what we can do is also to repent. So we repent, we can go to the venerables to repent, say, yesterday something happened, I tell a big lie and so on, and I feel very, very sorry about it. And so you can repent in front of the Buddha, you can repent in front of the venerables, Or if you did something not right, if you to someone, you go to that person and say sorry. Repent is basically to say sorry. We don't say sorry Buddha, I did so. It's not saying sorry to Buddha. In fact, you say sorry to yourself and to the person that you have offended, right? And the most important thing about repentance is actually for us to admit that we did make a mistake and set determination in ourselves not to do that again. Because if you take the courage and go to that person and say, sorry, I will not do it again, it actually shows your courage to admit your mistake, and that it, and because of that, the experience, you will actually remind yourself that I don't want to go through this embarrassing situation again, and I want to make sure that I remember not to do this again anymore. So it set the determination in yourself, and that you want to make sure that you do the right thing from now on. So repentance in Buddhism is not like you go to someone to confess and then it clean away your sins. It's not like that. But it's more admitting our mistakes, and that we want to set determination to change ourselves and try to tell ourselves to be more diligent from now on. Okay, so that's repentance. So that's five precepts. Now, so a lot of times people tend to think Buddhism emphasizes a lot on meditation. Meditation is very important, but as we say, the three essential practices in Buddhism is the morality, the meditation, and wisdom. So you can see that precepts is actually the foundation. Because you will never see a normal person very good in meditation doing uphold precepts. Or a bodhisattva who is very kind but not upholding precepts. Because you can see precepts is the foundation. Because if a person is a normal one, but then in terms of behavior is not ethical, you find that you can't earn people's respect, then how can you teach others? A bodhisattva who wants to help others, firstly, they themselves need to have good ethical values, good moral values, that they earn the respect of others. Then, plus their kindness and wisdom, you find that they can help others in a better way. And that's why whether they are arahats or the bodhisattva, you find that they all will uphold good precepts. But of course, they are, as we said, that during Buddha's time, the Buddha even don't even need to set precepts because people are pure in their mind. So if a person are very good in their practice and develop wisdom and see the truth, they know that all these afflictions are not necessary. They already let go their greed, hatred, jealousy, arrogance, then and selfishness, then their behavior are always in line with the precepts. And there are also people who practice well in meditation, because when you practice meditation well, your mind is more calm. You don't get agitated so easily by your afflictions. So usually their behavior will also be a bit more in line with the precepts. And then for us, not normal people who tend to get carried away by our desire, get agitated very easily, that's when we need the precepts one cross by cross, just as a mirror for us. I break this cross, then I break this cross as a mirror for us to make sure that we uphold them. So that's why this is called the pratimoksa, that if we can uphold one precept well, you got one precept, one 1% of freedom. For example, we say no alcohol. If you don't actually have the habit of drinking at all, and if your drinking is very awful, so when people say uphold the precepts of no intoxicant, to you it's very easy. You are free. You don't feel like it's a string that ties you down. Some people say precepts constrain us. Why do I want to follow a religion? It makes me feel more constrained. Cannot do this, cannot do that. And all these Buddhas and all these teachers always start to say not to do this, not to do that. But Why do we have this sense of constraint in our soul? Did the precepts constrain us? What has actually constrained us?
Our desire.
Right? So if the precepts, because if the precepts is constraining us, but then, as we say, like if we don't have the habit of drinking, the precepts is there. It doesn't affect you at all. You're still as free as you are. So, for example, someone don't have the habit of stealing. And you never even have that thoughts of like want to take advantage of anything, then that doesn't affect you as well. Right? You are free. So it is our desire. It is only when your desire feel like you want to do this, but the Buddha said, no, don't go beyond this. That's when you feel like, you feel like, I want to go that side, and I feel that it's okay to go there. Why you tell me not to? And that's where you feel constrained. It's like, just like a lot of kids, like parents say, don't play too much games. Don't spend too much time playing a Pokemon Go, right? But if you don't even know what is that, and you don't even want to play, who cares? Is that right? So it's our desire that actually constrains us. It is not the precepts that constrain us. So if we feel that when we want to uphold precepts, we feel the constraint, it actually shows that we have that desire. So it is actually good and also okay to have a sense of that if we feel that constraint and we understand that constraint is actually helping us, then we use that constraint to relate to the teachings and tell ourselves this is the kind of desire which is not necessary and learn to let go. So initially you may have a sense of feeling of constraint, but when you fall, if you try to practice in accordance to the teaching in the right way, then you find that at the end you will be more free. If you do not want to have this little bit of constraint right in the beginning, you say, who cares? I don't want to care about this Buddha's guidelines. I want to be free. Okay, so you just get carried away by your desire, and at the end, the precepts is not constraining you, but your desire is constraining you. You are being bogged down by your desire. You just can't get out from the desire. It's just like people who take drugs. They take a bit of drugs. They got addicted, and if it's just minor, say let go. Just don't do it anymore. And initially, when they want to tell themselves stop, they may have a few days, few weeks that they feel very uncomfortable because without those drugs. But then, if they are able to try to endure through, then they break through, and then they're free. Is that right? But if they can't stand that, and they say, oh, I like those feelings, and then they continue to take, it's going to be worse and worse and worse, and then at the end you are just reliant on those and on that drugs, and are you free? You are not free. Same thing with the precepts. You got a bit of constraint feeling, it actually shows our desire. If we can dissolve that desire, we are free. Alright, so that is the five precepts. Just now I did mention the eight precepts. The Buddha also said the eight precepts, which is on top of the five precepts for people who want to experience a bit of monastic life. So besides no stealing, no killing, no sexual misconduct, no lying, no intoxicants, the eight precepts have on top of that is no cosmetic and listening to music. The eight precepts are set for people who want to experience monastic life, and usually the lay people who want to experience monastic life, they go to the temple to live for 24 hours. Okay, so on that day, you want to look inward, reflect on yourself. So that's why no cosmetic and listening to music and movies and things as such. That is because When you go to a temple and you want to experience monastic life and you want to learn to be contented and you want to look inward, you still make up yourself, bring an iPad and start to watch movie for the whole 24 hours. You're not looking inward. Right? So that's why the Buddha set these rules, and you find that these rules is actually very, very good. I actually admire the Buddha's wisdom that 2,600 years ago he set these rules. Like, we are so reliant on our phone, our laptop, our Facebook. Every day you look on this and have all this communication. For 24 hours, put them aside. And it really allows you to feel that, today I can't touch my phone. And you keep thinking, when I finish my retreat today, not sure how many messages will there be, who will be calling me, and so on. You find that all these are actually a kind of attachment. So just by putting aside these things that we tend to just rely on so much every day, you put them aside, and it allows you to see your mind better. So that's the 6 precepts, and the 7 is what? No sitting or lying on luxury bed. So, luxury bed, comfortable bed, because it's a day that we want to experience contentment and monastic life. Because too comfortable a bed, firstly, we get lazy. And then secondly, it can also lead to unnecessary desire as well. So therefore, the Buddha set the precepts of no sitting on the luxury bed, because as when we say our senses organs contact with external environment, we have eyes contact, ears contact, nose, tongue, all this, and our body contact is a kind of sensual pleasure as well. So it's basically, these rules are basically for us to experience, to have a feeling of different sensual pressure as compared to the comfortable one that we have normally, for us to see how much we attach to the sensual pressure and what is the truth of this sensual pressure. At the end of the day, there are impermanence, they are actually a combination of causes and conditions. It is our sense organs contact with external environment that, with a transmission of information, we have conscious perception, conscious mental formation, and consciousness that we start to discriminate. Oh, this is a nice feeling, this is a not nice feeling. What is the truth of the feeling? Where is the feeling? So you can see that this 6 and 7 precepts tell us this, and the 8 precepts is to tell us not to eat after midday. So again, that's about food, that we tend to indulge in a lot of food every day, and a lot of time we eat extra, more than what is needed. So therefore, on that day, because you try to lead a simple life, we just don't eat after midday to experience a bit of hunger, understand, start to have sympathy to those people who have no food, and at the same time, understand how much we actually need per day. And also, by not eating after midday, it allows you to have a bit longer period of time to practice. Because if you prepare, you see, you eat your breakfast, eat your lunch. After lunch, you have to rest for a while before you can practice meditation. And after you practice a little while, you need to prepare for your dinner. And then you have to rest for a while. So there's a lot of interruption. And that's why, like some of you, when you study during exam time, sometimes you even forgot about your dinner. You just keep studying, especially when you start to concentrate. And getting up to go and cook, especially, or you go and buy, is easier. But if you are cooking, you see, mom at home, we have mom here, every day cook breakfast. After sending the kids to the school, they start to go to the market to buy veggie, buy whatever thing is needed, come back, cook lunch. And then after lunch, clean up, rest for a while, and then start to cook dinner. There's a lot of time spent. And so, therefore, one less meal is actually good in a sense that after lunch, you find that if you want to go a bit more in depth into a practice of meditation or your study of a sutra, you just can go uninterrupted for a long period of time. Okay, so that's the 8 precepts. So besides the 5 precepts, 8 precepts, there are also precepts that the Buddha set for Bodhisattva. So the Bodhisattva precepts includes, it can be categorized into 3 categories. One categories are precepts that tell us things that we should not do. One categories tell us things that good habits or good things that we should do, good practices that we should cultivate. And then the third section are rules and regulations that encourage us practitioner to be more proactive in going proactive in helping and guiding all sentient beings. So for the Bodhisattva, their mind, they need to develop the body mind, and the aim is to help and guide all sentient beings. So if a Bodhisattva see someone, say for example someone have an accident at the roadside, and they didn't try to offer some help to the Bodhisattva, is actually against their precepts. Because it's so precepts, just now we say are guidelines, they are actually guidelines and also areas of learning. For lay people, the areas of learning is the 5 precepts. For people who want to experience the monastic life, the area of learning is the 8 precepts. For the monks and nuns, the area of learning is the monks and the nuns' precepts. And then for the Bodhisattva, the areas of learning is the Bodhisattva precepts. So basically, there are guidelines to help us to develop our practice and the right mind in our practice. Okay, so that's why the 5 precepts, although it's the basis in practicing Buddhism, you find that it is very, very important. So not only that we want to listen to teachings, we want to practice meditation, but do not neglect the precepts. Because if we do not have good discipline, we do not have good moral values, and you call yourself a Buddhist, but you are doing the wrong thing, you actually not going to improve a lot in your own practice. At the same time, you may bring damage to Buddhism as a whole. That you call yourself a Buddhist, but why does Buddhist behave as such? Well, meditation and wisdom is still for your own self, but your behavior immediately will affect how people look at you, and especially when you identify yourself as a Buddhist, then you will bring the harm to the community as a whole. Right? So, but all in all, the 5 precepts is the basis to be a human being. So we need to make sure that we uphold the precepts well in order to maintain our human existence, and that we can have a happy and peaceful life. Okay? Right. 10 more minutes for you to ask questions. Any questions? Yes. Coffee and tea, not really. So intoxicants are things that confuse our mind. It really makes you lost your rationality. Yes, any other questions?
I'm from China, yeah. And I heard in China that if you are Buddhist, you can't eat meat. So is it the same?
Now, it's not saying that all Buddhists should not eat meat. This is especially for those who have already uphold the Bodhisattva precepts. Then they are not allowed, they should not eat meat, because the Bodhisattva developed, when someone uphold the Bodhisattva precepts, as I say, Bodhisattva precepts are area of learning for the Buddhists, for those who want to learn to be like a Bodhisattva. Bodhisattva are someone who developed the great mind in helping and guiding all sentient beings. They want to help sentient beings. So how can you want to help sentient beings and eat sentient beings? So therefore, anyone who uphold the Bodhisattva precepts will have to refrain from eating meat. But then for general Buddhists, then they may not necessarily be pure vegetarian. Buddha encouraged us to practice compassion. So during Buddha's time, the Buddha did say that because the Buddha's lifestyle is that they beg for alms from one place to another. So And they don't actually sort of inform the next village that we are coming to this village next tomorrow. Please, all of you cook vegetarian for us. He did not want to create trouble for anyone. So therefore, when he walked from one place to another, they basically accept whatever other people offer to them. Because you have to remember, the person who makes offering is also a sentient being that you want to help. So they just accept them, whatever people offer to them, whether they are meat or fish in there or just veggie in there, they just accept and eat without discriminating. So, and after eating, after accepting the food, they usually give a bit of dharma to the person as an opportunity to teach. And so, with a lifestyle as such, the Buddha did not strictly set vegetarian as a rules. But he did say that that monks and nuns are not supposed to eat meat that you know that people intentionally kill this to offer to you. You should not take it. Or you see that people kill and offer to you. You don't eat it. Or you suspect people kill this to offer to you. You don't eat it as well. So in other words, if a lay person invite the Buddha or the monks, the nuns to go to their house for dana, then they should not cook meat for the monks and the nuns, because it basically shows that, well, you invite them to your house for dana, and then you slaughter chickens, slaughter ducks for the Buddha. Well, you are preparing for the dana, so it's intentional. So therefore, a devout Buddhist who uphold the five precepts, when they make offerings to the Sangha members, it should avoid all this meat. Yeah, because the Buddha say the tree has to be free from these three suspicions that you know that people kill for you, or you actually see that people kill for you, or you actually have suspicions that this meat are killed for you, you don't take it. Yeah. So that's because the lifestyle that Buddha has at that time. But in all the Buddha's teaching, the Buddha encouraged us to have compassion. So that's why we're talking about no killing. Even animals live their life, don't kill. So, but because of the lifestyle that the Buddha have at that time, walking from one place to another for almsgiving, and that's why he did not strictly set it as a rule. But in the overall teachings of the Buddha, you can see that the Buddha keep highlighting that care for life and do not kill as one of the very important rules and guidelines. And so therefore, as a Buddhist, that when we learn the Buddha's teaching, we learn about the compassion of the Buddha, we should try to reduce eating meat, fish, animals as much as we can. Understand that when you're eating them, these are like just corpse, you know, it's just animals. They have been lively. If you share the feelings, then you probably don't feel like eating anymore. So becoming vegetarian is to cultivate our mind of compassion. It's not just I've become a Buddhist, so therefore I have to become a vegetarian, and it's just like a set rules, and you do not know why. It become like it's a rules that comes together with become a Buddhist. Then that's not necessary, right? But why do we want to practice vegetarianism? Is to tell us to be compassionate to the feelings of other sentient beings. So if someone just become a vegetarian because today I'm going to start a new business, I hope that this can create some good karma so that my business run well. So today I want to be a vegetarian for a day because this is a first day of my business. Then that defeats the purpose, because you're not actually practicing vegetarian out of compassion. You're practicing vegetarian for your own merits. Right? Of course, at the end, you don't eat for meat for a day. Some animals are being saved, which is good. But then it actually didn't achieve the purpose of purifying your mind. Does that make sense? Okay, thank you. Any other question?
So what happens if a precept is a little bit self-conflicting? For example, this is hypothetical, but like, what happens, for example, if killing one person would save the life of 1,000 people, for example, like, you know, if they kill hostage for a while?
All right. Now, there are stories in the sutra that talk about this, but this is in the Bodhisattva Sutra, where there are Bodhisattva who went on a, well, it's a group of merchants who gone on a ship for some treasure hunting. So they found the treasure, and the captain of the ship start to become greedy and want to get hold of all the treasure. So these merchants, or the leader of the merchant, knows about it. So he was thinking, what should I do? If I tell the rest of the merchant that this captain has got this bad intention of killing everyone and try to have the treasure for himself, then if all these 500 merchants knows about it, they probably will kill the captain first. So then the 500 merchants will commit the precepts of killing and create unwholesome karma for themselves. If I didn't tell them, and the captain kill all the 500 merchants, then the captain's going to create unwholesome karma. So what should I do? So the Bodhisattva, well, that Bodhisattva is not like us ordinary person, but he's very, very well in his practice. He has freed himself from self-centeredness, and had at the end he feel that, okay, I'll sacrifice myself. I rather I myself go to the hell rather than other people go to the hell. So therefore he decided that he wants to kill the captain so that the 500 people can be saved. But this is just a story that's not necessary that we can follow, because the merchant leader was a Bodhisattva who has actually free from self-centeredness. So in your situation that you say, what we can do is probably to think of the best way that we can, so that you can seek help, or you can just try to avoid killing as much as we can. That you say killing one person, you can save more, right? But besides killing, is there any other option? For example, you call for help, call for assistance, and avoid situation to get into state as such. So if we can take action a bit earlier than that, and so on. So try to think of any other option before you come to the last resort. And even when you come to the last resort, you actually don't try to kill with hatred. So, you can, well, it's not necessary for killing. Well, say, for example, sometimes even like police, do they actually need to kill the person? Is a question, because like if they hit onto the leg and the person can't run anymore, you can catch hold of the person rather than killing the person. You see? So there are options as such. Okay? Yeah. So just avoid killing is still the main thing. Any other questions?